panel is called Neo-Victorian Biofictional Narratives. So I guess, Diana, you won't really like this because of the periodization and the biofictionals. But I'm sure the girls will do their best to prove you that Neo-Victorian biofiction is something, and maybe it's weird, but it is something. And are we ready for...
Yes.
Yes, Amon. Okay. Hello. Sorry, guys. I was waiting for the right moment to turn my mic on. Hello, everyone.
All right. Hello, Barbara. Feels like spirit rapping. Yeah. I'm alone. Medium. So, without further ado, I'm going to present Barbara. So Barbara Reid is Assistant Professor of English Literature at the Institute of Literature and New Media at the University of Szczecin, Poland. And I'm sorry if I mispronounce this. Her research...
Recording in progress.
This is really spirit rapping. There's something, someone's calling around. Sorry. what was I saying? Her research interests, include Neo-Victorianism, biofiction, and adaptation. Her recent publications include a chapter on biofiction and the Neo-Victorian crime novel in Palgrave, a handbook of Neo-Victorianism that was published this year, and a journal article titled Queering the Female Writer in Screen Biofictions, Daphne and Shirley, that was published in Neil Helican, author this year. She's currently working on a book chapter on self-reflection. Self-reflexivity and in Neo-Victorian biofiction in a and she's also working on an article on Edgar Allan Poe's biographies and graphic narratives. And thank you, Barbara, for being online, and the floor is yours.
Lovely, thank you, and thank you for having me. Especially that it's extra hassle of all this technology, and I had to cancel last minute, really. So I'm especially grateful that you made this possible for me to present online today. And also, I feel like I need to maybe explain why I'm using the term Neo-Victorian, especially after today's keynote by Diana Wallace. Basically, because as you can see, the texts are set before Victorian period. It's going to be about Anne Lister, obviously. So I'm using this term, as I think most Neo-Victorians these days do, in a kind of very wide understanding of what Neo-Victorian comprises. So I'm basically thinking about the whole 19th century when I say Neo-Victorian. So, of course, no, this is definitely a topic for discussion, but I don't really have time for it right now, so maybe later. So I would like to start, of course, with the definition of biofiction, especially that even though I am using as a springboard these classic definitions, especially in the field of Neo-Victorianism, like the ones coined by Cora Kaplan and Mel Kolker and Christian Kleben and Michael Lackey. So you have them here. They usually focus on this mixture of fiction and biography, and on the role of the character, so historical figure as a character in biofiction. And while this is all true, I think that biofiction deserves a little bit more discussion when it comes to its characteristic features. I've been thinking, why we call biofiction and not traditionally biographical novel or biographical film. And I think that there is a certain new meaning to this term. And especially if we look at biofiction on screen or in popular media and popular literature. So my definition or characterization of biofiction, while it is based on these classic definitions and discussions, is probably closer to what Jerome was talking about yesterday about new trends in historical fiction. I think that there are many similarities here. So I think that in biofiction, especially in historical Neo-Victorian, the domination, the stress is on fiction and not fact. So while it is a mixture, fiction is more important, and facts are subordinate to fiction and to imagination and experimentation. And this might include not only fictionalization of the main character, but also very often emblematization or reducing the main character into a sort of remix of biographies. And by biographies, I mean not necessarily facts, elements that we know from historiography, but also legends, biomyths, collective imagination, and cultural legacy of a historical character. And also, neo-Victorian biofiction for me is post-authentic, anachronistic, and self-reflexive, and revisionary and reparatory, as very often neo-Victorian literature itself is as well. And this is a particular focus today for me, this revisionary aspect of neo-Victorian biofiction, especially in the context of queer fiction. And I also use the term in my title, apparitional lesbian, which is a term coined by Terry Castle, in which this phenomenon of historical virtual invisibility of lesbian desire is addressed. I think it's particularly interesting in the context of unlisted biofictions, because here the elements of biomythology, which you can see in maybe some case of some more famous characters like the Brontes or Dickens, these biomythological aspects are more important. Here they might be less striking, as it is actually Gentleman Jack that basically created this newly budding mythology of Anne Lister. So this particular aspect perhaps is different. But it does show a tendency for revision that's characteristic for neo-Victorian biofiction, and for a possibility of excavating the apparitional lesbian, either through research or through imagination. So that's what neo-Victorian biofiction tends to be doing, addressing this lack or virtual lack of visibility in history. And when it comes to queer historical biofictions or queering biofictions, there are two tendencies I see. On one hand, we have biofictions which aim to address historical traces that allow us to conceptualize or reconceptualize known women from the past as queer women. And such biofictions are often based on historical research, diaries, letters, etc. For example, Emily Dickinson in Wild Nights with Emily, or in the TV series Dickinson. Another tendency is to use imagination to reimagine women as queer, even though there is no documentation that to suggest that this could have been the case. So the claim of the director in the case of this example, Ammonite, in which Mary Anning is imagined as queer, the argument of the director is that it's undermining this proxy approach that by proxy, people in the past are assumed to be heterosexual. So it's imagining what if that wasn't true. And in a sense, this could be controversial for a number of reasons. In biofictions which are drawing on historical records to shed light on queerness of famous women like Dickinson, paradoxically, there might be an accusation of fantasizing or queer baiting for young audiences, because these texts would usually go against biomyths that have prevailed for decades or even centuries. Another possible problem is unavoidable anachronism. That's especially the case with queer identities in the past. Can we use such terms as queer or lesbian when we talk about the desire or identity of historical characters if they would not use such language themselves, or we don't have any information about their intimate lives, just traces, hints, and metaphorical language at best? On the other hand, when it comes to imagining characters as queer, there's the whole issue of what is the purpose of that. So there's been discussions whether it's done in the name of titillating voyeurism or whether it manages to obscure the professional achievements of women whose stories are being told in these texts. And when it comes to Annalista, it's a little different and maybe less controversial when it comes to the sources of biofictions. This is a special case because Annalista's diary is a source that allows us to say with confidence that she was queer, that there's little room for imagination as to her relationships with women and her own conceptualization of her own identity. Like I said before, this is this show particularly being a popular text establishes rather than debunks a biomyth. The diaries have been decoded rather recently in the 1980s, and there was a miniseries in 2010 done by BBC, but it wasn't as popular as this one, with much more production value behind it, which established Annalista as a queer icon for popular audiences. And therefore, we could say that in this case, biofiction does not debunk the myth, but maybe helps establish the myth. However, not everything is in the diary, it turns out. And this is exactly where Emma Donoghue decided to fill in the gaps with imagination. So this is when imagination becomes a tool to discuss things which cannot be known in history, from history. So that we'd like to look at these two examples as queer biofictions based on research on diary and partly imagined. And I would like to consider the crucial problematics of near-term biofiction as a genre, especially queer biofiction, in terms of its effort to recover the voices of the past and create new biomythologies. The question is, for instance, does neo-Victorian biofiction detract from or distort some of the other voices that are not the focal point of a given biofictional text? And also, I think that these particular texts draw our attention to the importance of historical documentation as a source, and it's also possible limitation and also the role of imagination in this reparatory function of biofiction. So Gentleman Jack, again, I don't know how much I have to introduce this show. It was made in 2020, the first season, 2022. In the second season, written by Sally Wainwright, who was very much invested in realism and in research in this show. This is a show which is very much focused on authenticity, which is seen in this production. For instance, the main location, Shipton Hall, this is actually the Shipton Hall, the actual building that belonged to Annalista. So it's historical setting, historical building that is used as location, which is not a usual thing to do in film production or TV production. Of course, there's some limitations because of the space. The house is not big enough for some of the scenes, for some of the shooting, but most of it was actually shot on location. The costumes also have received a lot of critical acclaim for both their authenticity and the way they communicate certain ideas about gender. Quite a lot of conscious effort goes into creating realism. That includes also using diaries as inspiration. It says here, this is the fragment of the opening credits. So it's research-based, it's diary-based, definitely. And the fact that it's an audiovisual text also encourages the audience to accept its realism as authenticity, which are not the same things, obviously. So the audiences are there's a tendency to accept things as we see them, as that's how they were. Alistair's point of view is actually the point of view of this TV series, which is stressed by breaking of the fourth wall element, which also serves as comic relief. It also serves as a metafictional meta moment that reminds us that this is Alistair's point of view because it's based on her diary. So we see things through her perspective. At times, this perspective is also a little bit skewed. So the voiceover is saying one thing, but the acting and the breaking of the fourth wall moment might be saying something else about the emotions of Alistair, for instance. So at times it looks like the narration is actually unreliable. It's been also noted by some scholars like Jennifer Reed and Ella Ben-Hangai and Eve Eng that the prestige of the production value, the prestige of the settings and costumes also translates into a certain seductive value in the series, which discourages audiences from holding Lister responsible for the class privilege she uses to maintain an imperious and dominating relationship she has to anyone with less power. This is a quotation from Reed and Hagai. And this is, I think, exactly what this show probably has to offer the most when it comes to queer biofiction and how queer figures from history are presented, particularly the production of masculinity by the main figure performed by Suran Jones. This production, of course, involves embodiment and performance, not only costume that I mentioned already, but also gestures and movement, walking, all these elements add to this performance. But the show also depicts her position of privilege, which is behind her unusually open experience of queer desire, her eccentricities, as they're seen by her contemporaries, exactly allowed because of her privileges of class and status. And this, in a sense, goes hand in hand with what's been noted by Jack Halberstam in definition of female masculinity, where masculinity is not just a question of a certain image or embodiment even, but it's also creating or associating with notions of power, legitimacy, and privilege and uneven distributions of wealth. So this is especially, I think, evident in season two, where Alistair's relationship with women in her life, her wife, Anne Walker, her ex as well, and many other women. This is especially evident that this relationship is fraught by certain features of toxic masculinity. And also we see how double standards work for Alistair in relationship to people from lower classes. In the first season, there's a scene in which she discusses the marriage of one of the young men in her village, at the same time fighting for her own right to marry whom she wants. So this kind of double standard is very, very closely evident. And throughout both seasons, especially first season, we have this ambiguity in how Alistair relates to Anne Walker. Is she a fortune hunter? Is she in love with Anne Walker? And in the second season, is she actually in love or is she a player? So this is clearly far from idealized vision of a character, a queer character. It also is escaping the trappings of kind of romantic, hugely romantic story. So you could ask yourself, is this a post-heritage or is it still heritage drama if we have this focus on prestige and on produce value, production value, and we have these quite conservative political opinions also of Alistair present in second season. So there are some elements here we could associate with heritage drama, but I think that nevertheless it's still post-heritage and neo-historical TV series. because it does distance itself from certain actions that are shown in this performance, and it is dealing with the issues of sexuality and gender in quite nuanced and complicated way, as I've been saying, and it also is quite self-reflexive in its approach to the issue of historical sexuality and historical identities. So I think in this way, it is also quite neo-historical. Now, Learn by Heart is a newer text written by Emma Donoghue, published in, written actually, well, the beginnings of it were written over 20 years ago, or the first ideas came to Emma Donoghue over 20 years ago. And throughout her career, she's been quite engaged in writing about Anne Lister, which she explains in her afterword to this novel. But the novel was completed during the COVID-19 pandemic and published in 2023. It is also a well-researched novel, very well-researched novel. And again, the afterword gives us a very detailed account of the resources that Emma Donoghue used, and also all the details that were not included in the novel itself. So she has managed to trace whatever is traceable quite well. But the problem is that not much is left of Eliza Raine's life. Eliza Raine is the main character of this novel, and she is Anne Lister's first lover. They met when they were 14 and 15, respectively, in a boarding school, manor school in New York, in 1804, 1805, roughly speaking, several months. So there is a double vantage point in a novel. One of them concerns those years, 1804, 1805, when the girls are at school together and they fall in love and they become lovers. And this is most of the narrative in the novel, written from the third person narration point of view, but the point of view is of Eliza. So we don't really see the point of view of Anne. Anne is seen from the outside, from Eliza's perspective. And this narrative is also the part of the narrative. The other vantage point is year 1815, when Eliza is institutionalized at Clifford House Asylum. And this part is within the first person narration as a letter from Eliza to Anne. So we don't really have Anne's perspective at all. And everything that is a dialogue or some sort of exchange, words from Anne are actually said from Eliza's memory through her eyes. And this is a kind of interesting turning of the tables, you could say, compared to Gentleman Jack. So Emma Donoghue says she used a pre-diary setting on purpose. So this setting, the years 1805, 1806, and 1815 are before diary starts. Actually, diary interestingly starts with Eliza, and this is the only time Eliza is mentioned. The first sentence is Eliza left us, and she's not mentioned at all in diary, and in Gentleman Jack as well, she's mentioned only once in season two, rather as a guilty memory and an interesting forerunner to Anne Walker. So going back to this issue that we don't really much know about Eliza, most of her documents were destroyed, partly because she asked Anne to burn her letters. So there's some papers and some documents telling us about her life. And this is important because she was of Anglo-Indian parentage, the illegitimate daughter of William Raine. We don't know much about her mother except for her being Indian, and she was born in India. When her parents died, Eliza and her sister Jane came to England, and they became wards of William Duffin, a surgeon in New York. They were quite well off, but their money were to be given to them when they get married or when they become 21, which is part of the plot of that in the novel as well. The fact that we don't know much about Eliza is the reason why Emma Donoghue chose this perspective, because she says that this allows her to give both of these characters kind of equal footing, right? So we don't know much about Lister before the diary and Eliza either, so both have to be fleshed out by imagination. So the it's interesting how to see how the authenticity of these texts is built, not on, again, diaries as a historical document, which seems to be, you know, the kind of automatic guarantee of authenticity. Here instead, there's a question of authenticity based on diary, how authentic or truthful biofiction based on diary would be if it's only Anne Lister's perspective. So we have to shake it up a little bit. Emma, I don't know who's doing this shaking up of this perspective, trying to imagine someone else's eyes on Anne Lister, not her own. Throughout the novel, of course, we have the issues of race, legitimacy, and finally madness as they shape Eliza's life. Both Anne and Eliza are peculiar, as they say, so queer, but only Anne is allowed to allowed freedom to express herself, and Eliza finally ends up in the asylum. And also there's an interesting turn of tables here, because at this point in her life, Anne is not rich and she's not yet the Lady of Schuttenhall. So it's Eliza who's more affluent, and that also becomes an important part of the relationship. It looks like, again, we have this kind of doubt whether Anne Lister is not using the fact that Eliza can afford certain things. And this is symbolized by the exchange of rings on their private marriage ceremony. Eliza gives Anne a diamond ring, one of the jewels that she got from her mother, whereas Anne gives her a straw one. Of course, it's about what they can afford, the financial position, but there's also a symbol of emotional investment. Diamond represents Eliza's powerful love to which she was loyal all her life, and finally led her to madness. And Anne's grass or straw made ring represents the fact that she quickly loses interest in Eliza. And there's several meta moments there. One of them is the what became the epigraph of the novel, which is an actual, as you can see in the photograph, it is an actual etching on the window in Manor House in the school. With this diamond, I cut this glass, with this face I kissed, alas. And the novelist imagined that this was Anne Lister who wrote this with the diamond of the ring. But it becomes kind of symbolic, especially the end of the novel, where Eliza wishes her name was actually etched in this poem, in this doggerel, and in this way she would be remembered, because she's scared that she will be forgotten. And this becomes this kind of meta commentary on the fact that she was almost virtually forgotten. But it makes me also think about how this poem could become, with this diamond I cut, alas, in the sense that she's been cut so deeply by Anne Lister. The diamond of her heart, of her love, was never really given back by Anne to her. Okay, I'm going to conclude, because I don't want to speak too much about this. So I think both these texts show that there's this importance of intersectionality of queer identities to take into account class, race, legitimacy of characters, to see the actual workings of privilege in these identities. I think that both these texts show the contrast between the paradoxical limitations of the diary being the source of historical fiction on Anne Lister and the possible potential, the preparatory potential of reimagined lives, lives imagined by the author here in this novel, which allows to recreate or recover what's been obliqued by historical documentation. Thank you very much.
So while the PowerPoint is being set up, let me introduce to you our next speaker, Jana Velova, who is a PhD student at the Department of English and American Studies at Masaryk University in Brno, Czech Republic. Research interests include historical and neo-Victorian literature, the portrayal of ostracized characters in the contemporary revisitation of the 19th century, canon formation, adaptations and appropriations of the 19th century, and a postmodern approach to historicity. Her work has been published in the British and American Studies Journal, BAS, and the Polish Journal of English Studies. And our talk is entitled Unveiling the Ordinary Other in Neo-Victorian Biofiction. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you. Okay. So, I'll try to keep it very brief. When looking at examples of the underprivileged other illustrating social inequality and class otherness, a noteworthy category of the female servant emerges. While the depiction of otherness rooted in race, sexuality, religion and morality has been scrutinized with attention to the neo-Victorian genre, there has yet to be a comprehensive critical examination of the neo-Victorian depiction of servants and servitude. As Jean Fernandez notes, servants were often overlooked in Victorian literature. The reason, as she writes, is the fact that the lives of the servant other lack development and progress. Because of this, servant narratives might struggle with the initial apprehension of depicting lives deemed uninteresting. However, neo-Victorian narratives experiment with the issue of invisibility and ordinariness. These experiments result in varied levels of development of the servant character, with instances of resistance against the erasure and control brought about by their circumstances. Barbara Braid points out that the female servant becomes the other for two reasons. She represents the lower classes and she's a woman. The otherness then can be expanded due to the implied ordinariness of the lives of the working women and the limiting roles they are supposed to embody, whether through the employment or the roles of mothers and wives in charge of the idealized domestic sphere. While the servant character is supposed to represent the opposite of the master, the roles within the two books I'm going to talk about today are not always that clear, resulting in blurring the lines between the superior and inferior, the one in charge and the one following the orders. This is commented on by Braid, who writes that neo-Victorian literature is not interested in perpetuating the limiting role of Victorian female servants. Instead, the novels about them are enabling their characters to transgress the traditional roles and characterization. The depicted lives offer a glimpse into a forbidden secret world, while also portraying maids as a subversive female power which revises the Victorian society through the eyes of working class femininity. This category of the subversive other can be seen as liminal in several ways. As Boran Puyol asserts, liminal women stand at the threshold between an old order and a new one, transforming their own story but also threatening to alter their environment. One form of liminality is influenced by the expected invisibility of these characters, who are supposed to work without being seen and exist in a household without occupying its main areas. However, their existence in the shadows is keenly felt in their neo-Victorian depictions, voicing their silences and tracking their steps through their in-betweenness. These characters are then taken out of the marginal form and brought into the foreground, portraying their noteworthy transformation. Another reason behind the liminality of servants is the inherent uncertainty of their lives. For example, ladies' maids' positions become insecure with their increasing age. So while their appearance and youth are rewarded by their access to the upstairs space where their mistress resides, once they get older, they get demoted to the downstairs, no longer having access to the mistress and the luxuries of such company. To start with, Margaret Foster's 1990 novel Lady's Maid tells the story of Lily Wilson, who was the maid of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. However, even the origin of the novel in itself represents a fight for relevance and attention. The life of Barrett Browning has been an inspiration for many revisitations that honor and examine a woman whose public and private personas prove to be a fascinating source. The idea to look into the shadows of the Victorian poetess and exploring her maid's life was initially entertained by Virginia Woolf. However, she decided to write a biography of Browning's dog Flush instead. It took almost 60 years for the idea to be brought into reality by Margaret Foster, who resurrected this character after writing a biography about Elizabeth Barry Browning. Therefore, Lily Wilson's secondariness is established not only in her life due to being a servant of a well-known and successful author, but also in the way she's remembered through a book that was considered only after exploring the seemingly more important story of her mistress. Wilson is described as a fairly uninteresting character, which is also influenced by the fact that her life and identity do not significantly develop until much later in the novel. This is commented on by Gutterbun and Robbins, who discuss the issue of who the real protagonist in the novel actually is. Understandably, the letters through which Foster accesses Wilson's past do not focus on the maid's point of view. Instead, they uncover the thoughts and feelings of her mistress. Therefore, Wilson appears destined to remain in the shadows of both the Victorian era and her neo-Victorian return. Nevertheless, it could be argued that Foster's portrayal aptly depicts a recovery project of silence or disregarded histories. Through the simplicity and ordinariness of Wilson, an intertemporal call for a change manifests in a narrative where the need to liberate and validate the maid's existence becomes crucial. After all, Wilson's life does not have to be overly exciting for her story to be considered worthy of revisiting. In the novel, Lily Wilson and Elizabeth Barrett Browning exist in a small space, reduced by Browning's illness and Wilson's social standing. As such, both could be described as occupying a liminal state that is temporarily halted and unchanging. Elizabeth's illness restricts her from truly experiencing life, and Wilson's desires to fulfill her own dreams of becoming a wife and a mother. She wishes to build a life where her importance can't be disputed, but she postpones this transition to take care of her lady. When describing the two women and their relationship, Warren Poole's discussion of quixotic women as another liminal category is particularly useful. Originating from Charlotte Lennox's 1752 book The Female Quixot or The Adventures of Arabella, the characters falling under the category of quixotic symbolizes substantial naivety, characteristic of both Elizabeth and Wilson's conduct. Elizabeth's relationship with her maid goes beyond the typical roles of mistress and servant. She hopes to be seen as a friend, but doesn't realize that her maid can't return the friendship without crossing boundaries. Although describing a character as quixotic might come across as negative, Warren Poyle also points out the positive stemming from it. As she notes, their period of quixotic delusion at least grants them an in-between position between freedom and submission, which usually coincides with their transition. During this stage, the voices of the double other, which are subversive women, are given expression. The additional delusions of both characters are varied, and while Warren Poyle notes that they often stem from the characters' inexperience and young age, even in their adulthood, Elizabeth and Wilson are still learning to navigate their roles and the limits of their voices. Since their development has been stunted, both women undergo significant transformations that are also related to marriage and motherhood later in their lives. And thus, their prior inexperience comes across as adolescent. When Wilson follows her newlywed mistress to Italy, she experiences loneliness caused by the distance from her family back in England, the strange land, but also distance from her mistress. Wilson becomes more aware of her reliance on her lady, also affected by her low wages, and therefore she transitions from the initial devotion to Elizabeth to dependency. As a result, it is not only the sickly mistress who depends on the maid, who's highly skilled in making Elizabeth comfortable. We can see that Wilson requires attention and closeness, which she had previously deemed improper for a maid to expect. Their dynamic is changed by the addition of Elizabeth's husband, Robert Browning, who logically becomes Elizabeth's priority, making Wilson more aware of the emptiness of her mistress's prior promises of friendship and companionship. So we see that Lily becomes trapped between the role of a maid and a friend, a confidant and an outsider, a woman and a provider, since she's also expected to take care of her family back home, since she's the oldest child. And therefore she's torn between admiration for her poet mistress and indignation at her selfish disregard for her servant's economic and personal difficulties. The relationship and employment which changed Wilson's life and allowed her to see places which would otherwise remain unattainable also leave the maid in a claustrophobic prison, ridding her of her agency and free will. The control Barrett Browning possesses over the maid is reflected in all aspects of Wilson's life. Even the death of the mistress does not sever the link between them, as Wilson remains the maid who had the, quote, privilege of being close to her mistress. This connection is described as haunting by Holly Blackford, who notes that the servant and her mistress share privacy and intimacy normally reserved only for lovers. Yet they struggle for power until one or the other dies or leaves the house. Such struggle is particularly observable in Wilson, whose identity revolves around her work and thus servitude. She questions who she is without her mistress and fears being separated from her while the mistress is still alive. Whether intentional or not, Barrett Browning replaces Wilson's family and enforces the maid's dependence on her, which matches her own reliance on the servant. Now, moving on to the second novel, we can see that there are many parallels between the story of Lily Wilson in Lady's Maid and the protagonist in Pallinger's book, Sally Nardred. To both women, their employment as a lady's maid is an integral part of their identity, and they rely on their mistresses and suspend their own lives to assist them. While Wilson travels to Italy with her sickly mistress, Sally moves to Egypt, where Lady Duff Gordon relocates based on her doctor's recommendation. Duff Gordon, who was an author and translator during the Victorian era, is described as an intelligent and charismatic woman. Sally is indebted to her mistress, who nurtures the maid's curiosity and desire for knowledge. Duff Gordon, who herself surpasses many men in her wit and intelligence, sees the education of her servants as a worthy endeavor. Her approach proves beneficial, as after both women move to Egypt, they experience shared transformation while gradually adapting to the local customs and language. This brings Sally and her mistress even closer together, as they rely on each other for company in a strange land. Yet the transformation from British to Oriental, as depicted in the novel, is not complete, and instead, Sally and her mistress exist in a makeshift bubble of mixed customs, leaning towards one culture or the other, depending on what they deem more comfortable. Besides this, another similarity between Foster's and Pallinger's novels is the adamant subscription to the Victorian and English rules of conduct. In both works, the maids Wilson and Sally become pregnant out of wedlock, and their change state is then concealed from their mistresses, resulting in a form of banishment in both cases. As Harman and Llewellyn note, however progressive in theory their views were on class or race relations, Victorian female middle-class intellectuals and writers like Duff Gordon and Barrett Browning were incapable of moving beyond a near feudal conception of their servants. Both novels depict moments of friendship and closeness, seemingly transgressing the class divide. In The Mistress of Nothing, these transgressions are intensified by the environment, as the complicated ways of life and clothing associated with England are abandoned in favor of simplicity. Nevertheless, both Wilson and Sally are quickly made aware of the fragile position within the lives of the mistresses. In Sally's case, concealment and invisibility become a significant part of the novel, as the mistress eventually decides to erase the maid from her life. As Catherine Wynne notes, the erasure also affects Duff Gordon's work Letters from Egypt, from which the maid disappears after her pregnancy. The disappearance is caused by Sally's betrayal when she breaks her unspoken promise of remaining a spinster by her lady's side. Instead, she falls in love with an Egyptian servant, and Lady Duff Gordon refuses to accept this. It becomes clear that while the mistress is allowed to change relatively freely, the maid's allowed changes are merely an illusion of freedom. What follows is a move away from love and friendship towards hatred, with the mistress resenting the maid for being able to undergo a transformation she herself no longer can. Lady Duff Gordon's family does not follow her to Egypt, and with the passing years, the mistress becomes aware of the increasing emotional distance between her and them. As a result, the female companionship featured prominently prior to Sally's pregnancy falls apart. Furthermore, although Duff Gordon wants to erase the servant from her life and memory, she's also resolute in determining Sally's future. The mistress realizes that despite the seeming superior role she has in relation to her servants, she's unable to fully control them. And thus, although the rigid English class divisions become porous in the contact with another culture, they are then reinstated with a vengeance. The mistress dismisses her maid and orders her back to England, while Sally's child is supposed to remain in Egypt. This deliberately pushes the maid to the margins, isolates her, and also invalidates her marriage, since it's not legally recognized in England because her husband is already married to someone else. This leads to another significant aspect of neo-Victorian servant narratives, which is the depiction of the victory of the servant over the oppressive rules of her masters. While the victory seems incomplete and complicated at the end of Lady's Maid, where Wilson still grapples with her conflicting opinions of her mistress, leaning towards devotion or dislike, Palinger depicts a more discernible triumph of her maid. Hudson notes that the impulse of servant narrative is one of resistance. A figure subject to another's will does in fact possess an individual voice that can be offered in opposition to the narratives of socially dominant characters. Palinger's depiction allows the maid to undergo a split from her mistress, and while emotionally taxing, the novel provides a moment of victory for a maid who has been betrayed and abandoned by her employer. She refuses to go back to England and leave her child, and instead, Sally finds another employment in order to provide for herself and build a new life. Besides the already mentioned similarities between the two novels, another significant quality is their biofictionality. In her definition of neo-Victorian biofiction, Colquay proposes three modes of neo-Victorian life writing: celebrity biofiction of marginalized subjects, and appropriated biofiction. The lives of Lily and Sally fall under the second mode, dealing with marginalized subjects. However, as Colquay adds, this type of life writing is often attractive not for its depiction of the margins, but the skewed insights and revelations into the more noteworthy personalities. Therefore, the novels can also be seen as examples of celebrity biofiction, spending considerable time on the depiction of Barrett Browning and Duff Gordon. Nevertheless, it is essential to note that, for example, in Lady's Maid, the story doesn't conclude once Barrett Browning dies. Thus, even if the book might sometimes blur the lines between whose story is to be paid attention to, it is the maid's death mentioned in the afterword that concludes the novel. Without her mistress, Wilson's voice also comes forth more prominently. The maid is undoubtedly marked by her years in service, and she undergoes a transformation that turns her into a disillusioned wife, an imperfect yet dedicated mother, a failed housekeeper, but also a treasured friend for Browning's son, Pen, with whom Wilson moves in later on. Another noteworthy aspect of these novels is the viewpoint that Wilson and Sally should also be grateful to their mistresses for the existence of the work depicting parts of their lives. It is impossible to know whether the maids would welcome such revisitation. And this is something pointed out by Colquay and Casaubon as well, as they note that biofiction raises questions about individual rights to privacy, posthumous libel, and historical distortion that intersect with contemporary concerns about the barrel culture of confessions and fake news. Similarly, Boldrini writes that ethical questions are at the core of the form. So while Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Lady Lucy Duff Gordon can be considered public personas, Wilson and Sally remain private figures, reflected in the lack of textual evidence attached to their lives. Nevertheless, the connection between the two women and their mistresses leads to works that take Wilson's and Sally's side, illuminate the story, and even without romanticizing or sensationalizing their characters, provide evidence of the significance of giving them a voice. So to conclude, these examples have hopefully illustrated the importance of examining neo-Victorian portrayals of servitude, which besides the typical depiction of ostracized and marginal characters, also illuminate the struggle between the two othered women, the maid and her mistress. The fragile illusion of control reflected in the lives of mistresses and their servants makes them subject to unexpected changes, launching or returning them to their liminal and marginal positions. Through their invisibility and ordinariness, neo-Victorian female servants are able to escape the tight boundaries of their class and gender and turn into worthy symbols of transformation that resonate with contemporary audiences. Thank you.
Barbara's talk before, but also with what was said earlier on, well, yesterday on Sisterhood, maybe, but something for the questions. No, we're going to hear Isabelle Roblin, sitting on my right, who's an honorary assistant professor at the Université Littorale Côte d'Opale in France, specializing in contemporary British literature, and who has published many academic papers on, there is a long list here, bear with me, A.S. Byatt, Graham Swift, Kazuo Ishiguro, C.S. Forster, Salman Rushdie, John Fowles, Anne McEwen, amongst others, and today you are adding a new one. Recently, she's been focusing on new Victorian novels, and she's been working at the same time on the literary and filmic adaptations of novels. In 2011, she published a critical study of all of Howard Pinter's screenplays entitled Howard Pinter, La Liberté Artistique et ses Limites. And today, so as I said, she's adding to the list of authors, and she's going to present a paper on Graham McRae Burnett's his Bloody Project, a slippery neo-historical novel.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, so from the title page onward, Graham McRae Burnett's Bloody Project is deliberately baffling for the first-time reader. It is made up of several it is made up of several documents relating to the case of Roderick McRae, edited and introduced by Graham McRae Burnett, also GMB. However, on the very same page, it is also presented as a novel. Moreover, the preface and the contents of this fragmented text continue with the literary jeu d'esprit and make his Bloody Project a resolutely postmodern historical novel in its presentation. However, the use of scrupulous verisimilitude, a traditional technique of a conventional historical novel in terms of setting, language, description of feudal conditions in the 19th century Highlands of Scotland, etc., as Rousselot said, distinguishes it from the more explicitly self-reflexive mode of postmodern parody. It can thus be considered as a post-postmodern or neo-historical novel, a new subgenre of contemporary historical fiction. I shall first examine in detail the claims made by the supposed editor of the novel and the way in which this collection of allegedly found documents is part of a long literary tradition, playfully blending as it does reality and fiction. Then how, without any hint of nostalgia, it engages with a Scottish mid-Victorian past it depicts for the 21st century readers and leaves them wondering about the mutability and ultimately the unutterability of truth. Let us consider some of the well-known postmodern neo-Victorian elements in this novel. First, there is a slight ambiguity as to the nature of a novel, which deftly masquerades as a slice of true crime. It certainly qualifies as historical crime fiction, but it's not a conventional whodunit, as there is no suspense per se. Indeed, the reader knows from the start, it's the beginning of the account of Roderick McRae, which is also quoted in the author's preface, that Roderick, or Roddy, has committed the three very brutal murders he is accused of, and, as he says himself, has no wish to absolve himself of the responsibility for the deeds he has lately committed. Therefore, the only question is what led this articulate young man, he is 17 at the time, to commit such atrocities. Was he always a wicked boy, as some witnesses claim? Or was he not of a sound mind, as others argue? Or was he driven to this desperate act by misery and exploitation, or, as he says himself, by the tribulations his family had suffered at the hands of a village constable, Lachlan Mackenzie? Since there is no overall meta-narrative binding the different points of view together, it is up to the readers to make up their minds, and so to speak, to weigh up the evidence from the fragmented discourse and the multiple and often conflicting points of view, something the editor himself acknowledges in the preface. Commenting on the various discrepancies, contradictions, and omissions of a text, he concludes, "Naturally, I have come to my own view of the case, but I shall leave it to the reader to reach his or her conclusions." Moreover, the very structure of the book, with the different voices and viewpoints on the central events, really invites the readers to play detective, play psychologist for themselves. And in throwing readers in us into doubt about which, and more crucially, whose story we are supposed to be following, Burnett encourages us to look more closely at the inherent instability of fiction itself. So indeed, the novel is a compilation of documents, which you can see. The first person confession, the account of Roderick McRae, followed by a helpful glossary to translate into English some of the most obscure Scottish words he used, is by far the longest, 140 pages. There is also a map of a real life village of Caldew, on which the houses of the main buildings, church, school, and the imaginary houses of the principal characters of a story are indicated. Then transcripts of contradictory interviews with some of the imaginary inhabitants of a village, including the minister and the schoolmaster, are also included, as are made-up post-mortem reports carried out on the victims, newspaper articles covering Roderick's trial, and excerpts from a fictional 30-page memoir, Travels in the Borderlands of Lunacy, written by the real Scottish prison physician, J. Bruce Thompson, one of the doctors who supposedly interviewed Roderick in prison. Finally, an epilogue in the third person, by a heterodiegetic narrator, tells of the last days of a young man before he is eventually hanged in prison, and it also sheds light on the title of the novel. It is therefore up to the so-called editor to provide for the 21st century reader the complete memoir on the document of the case in book form, because it had been supposedly published before in the story. The last section of the novel is the 21st century author's historical notes and acknowledgements. As Catherine Harris remarks, most commonly used in historical fiction to identify how accurate the text is, author's notes have been used to polish the boundaries between history and fiction and to demarcate their complicated relationship. So beside the fragmentation of a text, typical of postmodern historical fiction, as Mitchell and Parsons noted, another postmodern element can be found in the status of the author. Indeed, on the title page and in the preface, Graham McRae Burnett presents himself not as the author, but as the editor, edited and introduced by Graham McRae Burnett. He relates how, while researching his family history in the Highland Centre Archive Centre in Inverness, which is a real place, he came across some newspaper clippings describing the trial of Roderick McRae and discovered the memoir the young man had written in jail at Inverness Castle during the summer of 1869 while awaiting trial for murdering three people. He stresses that his editorial intervention are restricted to matters of punctuation and paragraphing, and that he did not attempt to improve the text or correct awkward turns of phrase or syntax, as it would, as he says, only serve to cast doubt on the authenticity of the work. As Bergman points out, assuring the reader of the authenticity of a story is a topos as old as the genre itself, and among the most common devices the early practitioners of the genre used to give their writing the touch of truthfulness. One of the devices was a reference to an old manuscript. Thus, for example, Cervantes pretended he had found Don Quixote in the market in Toledo, One of Edgar Allan Poe's short stories supposedly came from a manuscript found in a bottle. Nathaniel Hawthorne also alleged to be but the editor of a manuscript of a Scarlet Letter he had discovered on the second story of the Custom House. And more recently, Alistair Gray, one of Burnet's fellow Scottish writers, reported coming across Poor Things among old-fashioned box files left on the edge of a pavement in Glasgow. The question of the authenticity of a document is addressed by GMB himself at some length in the preface. Given the Scottish context, a playful tongue-in-cheek reference is made to the controversy surrounding the Poems of Ossian, a supposedly great epic of Gaelic poetry, which the Scottish poet James Macpherson had claimed to have collected, translated into English, and then published in 1765, and which had quickly assumed the status of a classic of European literature before it was later found to be a clever fake. For its part, his bloody project also professes to be a crude crime writer story, a case that was something of a cause célèbre at the time. Moreover, the similarity of the names of the author-editor, Graham MacRae Burnet, and the protagonist, Roderick MacRae, reinforces the illusion of kinship between the two and gives a seemingly personal spin to the tale. However, most savvy 21st century readers, like we are, tend to be skeptical about the claims of authors to authenticity, even if apparently many of them, and even a few reviewers, thought the story told by Burnet was an actual reimagining of a real-life story. Yet, the title page qualifies the story as a novel, okay, in big block letters, which is a dead giveaway. Like Alistair Gray, GMB pays homage to his literary forebears and inscribes his novel within a well-known literary tradition, but also clearly enjoys blurring the boundaries between reality and fiction and playing games with his readers, a typical postmodern and neo-Victorian literary gesture, which is not limited to the title page or in the introduction, but also permeates the story. Indeed, as the author himself has indicated in his historical notes and acknowledgments section of the book, one or two of the characters were real people. For example, James Bruce Thompson was a real-life Scottish prison doctor and a pioneer of criminology. And Lord Middleton was indeed, at the time, the largely absentee laird of an estate that encompassed several villages, including Applecross and Culdy, where the story is set. There is also tension between two contradictory impulses. On the one hand, Burnet wants the reader to be immersed in the world of a book, primarily to believe that the characters are real, as he says, but on the other, he also wants them to understand that it is a work of fiction, adding that he takes it as a compliment to the writing when people have regarded the documents as actually real. This paradox is the essence of postmodern works, as Bergman remarks. Right from the very beginning, the authors of historical romance, though they knew that the genre was calling for authenticity, at the same time put emphasis on the fact that they were writing fiction. She also concedes that, surprisingly, readers tend to notice the hints of truth and authenticity more than the often only slightly concealed allusions to fictionalization. There is, however, more to the novel than metafictional games with the reader. Burnet, whose background is in investigative journalism, did some serious research into the period and says that he was shocked to discover the terrible conditions that the oppressed Highland crofters, who worked small plots for small plots of land rented from the laird, lived under in the mid-19th century. Since they and their plight were hardly mentioned by Victorian writers, Scottish or otherwise, he decided he wanted to make them heard, another well-established neo-Victorian feature. Indeed, as Mitchell and Parsons, among others, note, the format of a neo-Victorian novel in particular highlights the advantages of fiction in giving voice to silenced groups, a trait long recognized and connected to its ability to imaginatively go beyond the established facts of a historical novel. They add that the value of fiction for revising or fleshing out the omissions of a historical record extends beyond its ability to imagine lost subjectivities and speak with silent voices into its creation of multi-layered texts that can incorporate and hold in tension multiple perspectives, which is exactly what Burnett's novel does. Burnett also uses the mode of verisimilitude, a conventional technique of a historical novel characterized by the illusion of reality it seeks to convey, to distinguish it from the more explicitly self-reflexive mode of postmodern parody, as Rousselot said. He thus uses archive material to prop up its story. For example, one of the most absurdly Kafkaian episodes of Roddy's story, when his father is forced by the constable, Lachlan Mackenzie, to put back into the sea the seaweed his father he had been painfully collecting to spread it on his field to nourish his crop, because he had not asked the landlord's authorization to do so, is directly inspired by the regulations which governed the lives of crofters on the nearby island of Skye in 1881. The rule stated that the shellfish on the shore, the heather on the hills, and the fruits of the shore, including seaweed, were the property of the laird and could not be taken without having sought his permission. Even if the author says that he is not sure how strictly the regulations were enforced, for the 21st century reader, this is another piece of evidence of the injustice of the feudal conditions under which the Highland crofters continued to toil during the Victorian era. The contemporary readers of neo-Victorian fiction in general, and of his Bloody Project in particular, might be comforted in what they think they know about the appalling conditions of life for the poorest classes in Victorian Britain. However, Burnett also counters his readers' perceived preconceptions of the Victorian era in another domain. He says, "We tend to associate 19th century Highland communities with the church and Presbyterianism," he says, "but I realized there was a strong strain of folklore. People call it superstition, but it is a belief system just as religion is a belief system, so I would not want to place one above the other." In his story, the opposition between the hell and fire teachings of a Presbyterian minister and some magical pre-Christian elements is embodied within secondary characters. For example, both Roddy's sister Jenna and his mother Una are perceived to have second sight, okay, to have a second sight, and to have visions that may foretell the future. Whereas his father is a devout and obedient follower of a sternest Presbyterian doctrine. This part of the story could be construed as an attempt to recreate a more complex society than the somewhat stereotyped vision of contemporary readers might have of 19th century Scotland, but it also can be seen as a form of exoticism, to quote Elodie Rousseau's term. With the geographical displacement of the exoticist project being replaced by the historical distance. As Marie-Louise Kolker remarks, neo-Victorianism has become the new Orientalism, particularly in its representation of the 19th century. Indeed, the characters are seen by readers as alien, as radically other. However, in the case of his Bloody Project, in contrast with many other neo-Victorian novels, where the representation of the past is perceived as celebratory or nostalgic, contrasting with the present unfavorably with an idealist past, there is no nostalgic tendency for the past it creates. On the contrary, it is represented as incredibly bleak and uninspiring. The danger of such representation is that it can lead to the contemporary reader to the conclusion that such otherness is in fact inferior to the present, and to the assumption of a present as intellectually and morally advanced. This is the case, so I'm going to go very quickly there. So this is also the case in the presentations of some of the characters in the novel. I'm going to skip this part, because in this examination of a period, the novel is almost a sociological account of life in a small Scottish rural community in the mid-19th century. Bernard drew his inspiration from a case in 1835 in rural Normandy, in which a young Frenchman, Pierre Rivière, brutally murdered his mother and two siblings with a pruning hook. So he said, to free his father and himself from his mother's tyranny, and then wrote a memoir to justify what he had done. The true story was used by the French philosopher Michel Foucault in his study of the history of relationship between psychiatry and criminal justice, first in his seminar in the Collège de France. He then co-edited and published Pierre Rivière's memoir along with the documents of a case he had found in the archives in Caen under the title Moi, Pierre Rivière, ayant égorgé ma mère, ma soeur et mon frère. I, Pierre Rivière, having slaughtered my mother, my sister and my brother, which is one of the five volumes mentioned in the historical notes as a main source of inspiration. A film of the same title, directed by René Alliot, was later released. The structure of the two narratives is very similar and composed of several documents organized in chronological orders, and the centerpiece, and I'm going to finish here, being Pierre Rivière's autobiographical memoir, written when he was awaiting his trial in prison in Vire. Bernard also follows Foucault's mythology, as the French philosopher explains, see if it's here, so I'm not going to read it. As Jean-François Berthe notes, Moi, Pierre Rivière is a sociological and historical document of prime importance, and the collective work undertaken by Foucault's team proposing an important renewal in the way of writing history. While the subjective dimension of historical work is broadly admitted by Foucault, in his text, he seeks not to exhaust the crime by explaining it with a logical system, whether sociological or anthropological or historical, but to render Pierre Rivière's act impossible to assimilate, as he says, by making stick in our throats like an anxiety. So, even though Moi, Pierre Rivière is a real-life story and His Bloody Project a fictional one, they nonetheless share a similar sociological approach to the story they tell. At the end, even if we, as 21st century readers, do commiserate with Roderick MacRae, unanswered questions remain as to the reasons for his crime, and for example, the part is sexual frustration, never explicit in the text, but very much implied, played in the murder of the constable's daughter, Flora. So, like Pierre Rivière's story, Roderick MacRae is indeed impossible to assimilate and does stick into our throats. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you very much, Jan and Isabel and Barbara, for this panel that brought up again questions of authenticity, of what we are doing with the archive when we actually are writing fiction and how we recreate things. I have, it's more for Jana and Barbara. because you, yeah, thank you. because you both dealt well with female figures, and I was thinking of the way maybe your papers echo, even if in a different way, work with maybe the idea of sisterhood that was brought up in a paper on yesterday morning panel. And so, does that come into play in the servant mistress relationship? Does it come into play maybe in in the works that you studied, Barbara. So I don't know who wants to react to this.
Oh, if I may. So I found it particularly interesting, the discussion of sisterhood yesterday, because I started immediately thinking about these two novels and how in these two works there are instances of friendships which we could theoretically categorize as sisterhood in a way, but it seems to be an illusion, something that is never truly revisited the moment that these maids transgress their position. So what, the moment that they do something that their mistresses don't like, it's over, unfortunately for them. So instead, the ladies, the mistresses in these works are portrayed as the villains of the story. And this is something that Gatterburn, for example, criticizes when talking about Lady's Maid, because he talks about Foster's approach to Elizabeth Barry Browning and giving her voice and putting words in her mouth that are not real, or at least Foster doesn't have any access to some of these things, and that's something that he says that, well, that she's made into this villain with words that she never actually spoken. So okay, there are occasions of sisterhood, but it's more of an opposition. Okay. Yeah, in these two novels.
Barbara, do you want to react?
Sorry, let me just make sure, because I don't really hear that well. So you want me to comment on the topic of sisterhood in these texts?
Yes, I don't know if it's relevant, but yeah.
Sorry, because possibly I wasn't also present during that paper yesterday, because I had to teach yesterday. Well, I think there are very different ways this could be understood in these two texts to discuss, because in Gentleman Jack we have very literal sisterhood, so Anne's sister and their relationship is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think this relationship shows how little Anne had patience for actual, you know, more traditional experience of women. She doesn't really care much about what is the actual experience of women like her sister who cannot marry. I mean, or she feels like she has a little chance to marry, and this relationship is very fraught. I think there's a much more sympathetic depiction of more metaphorical sisterhood between girls in the school in Emma Donoghue's Love novel. It's actually a very interesting aspect showing this early 19th century school for girls and the relationship between these girls, and it's a very interesting and very touching, because Madonna, I think, is very good at showing childhood and teenagehood, so it's a very touching picture of these relationships and friendships between girls and how they were tormented also by their future, by the fear about their future marriages and whether they have a chance for happiness and illnesses and relationship with parents or lack of parents. So it's actually a very good novel in this respect of showing, you know, girlhood, I suppose.
Thank you. questions from the floor.
I have a question for Barbara Redd. Well, thank you for your presentation. It was very interesting. I was wondering, do you think that the second season of Gentleman Jack is as authentic as the first season?
As what? Because I didn't hear that one word. As
authentic.
As authentic. Well, I think it depends on how we define authenticity. So that is a big question, right? What is authenticity? And I actually think about authenticity more in terms of reception. I think that this concept, it fluctuates depending on the expectations of the audiences, particularly when it comes to media products, audiovisual texts like TV series. I think people have a certain affective relationship perhaps to what is supposedly authentic on historical television. And so, yes, that's a big question. Do people want authenticity in terms of mise-en-scene, or do they want authenticity in terms of fulfilling their expectation concerning this big queer hero? Because that is the big reason why this TV show is so popular. It's meeting those needs of queer audiences, and therefore it was perceived as, yes, this is the authentic queer life in 19th century. This is fulfilling certain needs for historical depiction of queerness. But I personally, if I was to talk about my own expectations of authenticity, I think that second season is perhaps more authentic than the first, because it's less romantic. So we still have these remnants of romantic discourse, romantic plot in the first season. It seems to be like, you know, going towards this marriage, which is the finale of the first season. This is, seems to be the main arc of the narrative. Even though we do have these intersectionalities in Anne's sister performance, that, you know, her relationship with her, with the villagers and with her family and her, you know, business, how it goes. But I think that it's still more romantic. I think in the second season, we have this more fraught picture of Anne Lister, how she isn't a perfect lover or husband for Anne Walker, and how she has secrets in her past, including Eliza. I think that might be a more authentic, if we understood authentic as more fleshed out or more complicated image of a queer heroine, if you want to use that word. I don't know if it answers your question, but that's how I feel about it. Thank you.
Other questions? Amel.
Thank you, all of you. It's not really your question, actually. Just one thing for Diana. I was thinking, listening to you, I was thinking of another novel, The Observations, by Jane Harris?
Yes. I do talk about the novel in the chapter, yeah.
All right, okay. Because that seemed quite relevant. And the other question, that's not a question, it's more of a remark for Isabel, is that you insisted on the link with Poor Things, which I thought was, and then I thought, okay, well, Poor Things, you know, that's 30 years old, okay, very postmodern, you know, what now? And I think you've shown quite well the difference with now, with the neo-historical, in the sense that with this insistence on the sociological dimension. So I suppose it's, you've given us quite a good example of, that book is quite a good example indeed of what the neo-historical can be, with this tension between the quest, the pretense of authenticity, of accuracy, and at the same time showing, oh, well, this is only a creation, this is only fiction. So,
yeah. Because Poor Things, of course, is
all made up.
Yeah, and it's all sorts of elements which are not at all realistic. Yeah, that's right. I think this literary tradition of pretending to find a manuscript, which is, I was wondering why he did that, because it can seem so hackneyed, in fact. Mm. But I think it's to put himself in the literary tradition, or to in line with a greatest, or perhaps because, or just playing games, I don't know. Well, homage to the Scottish tradition of fakes and so on, perhaps also, because it's quite important. I mean, I was really amazed that many people believed that it was a true story. But mind you, people thought that Ashley was a real poet.
Exactly,
you know,
I did.
Yeah, but it's written a novel in the title page.
Exactly,
yeah.
It's so convincing
Afterwards.
Mm. Mm. But for Ash, I'm sure I've said this before,
yeah.
I remember that when I started the novel Possession, yeah. I was started reading it in bed, and then I thought, Ash, oh, who's this poet? I don't remember him, so I went up to check on my dictionary of authors, you know, saying, who is he?
Yeah.
And then, of course, it dawned on me. Anyway.
But to bounce back on this aspect, because you don't know if it's real or not, unless you pay attention to like this, that is a novel. But I was also interested in the fact that, as you said, it's a true crime story, and
but it isn't a true crime story.
Yeah, but I mean, there is the detective kind of play.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering whether. This confusion might not come from the fact that there are so many novels and TV shows about true crime that are romanticized and that are becoming themselves a story of fiction. And maybe can you comment on the link between on that further? Sorry, I'm not clear.
His first novel is also about it's also about a fake. I mean, it's a and it's it was called and so, and the fact that he chose it was clearly inspired by Foucault, Pierre Rivière. I mean, I think he insisted upon that, and it's a very similar, and the idea of it's not a whodunit because we know from the start but it's the why. Okay, and that's why and what pushed these two young men to do such a horrible thing, and I think it's the sociology which is what's really interesting, because Foucault's Pierre Rivière, the life of a peasant in Normandy, is much better than the life of the crofters in the Highlands in the 19th century. So I think that it's being inspired by Foucault. And Foucault is quite, because when I looked at the acknowledgement and I had a look at Foucault's book, I mean, the structure is incredibly similar. I mean, I think it's what he wanted to do. I mean, using a crime story, to bring to a foreground other questions, more or less sociological, bringing to mind the very harsh conditions of life of the peasants at the time as well. Mm. Once again, the unsung, untold, voices of the Victorian period in Britain and 19th century in France. People are not interested in them except when they commit crimes. And that's
I had another question, remark, I don't know, because you mentioned about, you know, those peasants from the Highlands. You mentioned the use of second sight.
Yeah.
At some point you related that to exoticism, but I was thinking, is it also used in the novel as a way of reflecting, because second sight is about seeing the future, and is it also used in the novel as a way maybe of introducing anachronism, maybe, or to connect a bit with what we've been saying earlier?
I don't think so. Because it's that's what it's. I think it's because I mean when we think of Presbyterian Scotland, we think of the Highland Fire, the sermons of the Reverend, which were also in the book, but we tend to, and it's the same in Normandy in a way. We tend to forget the le rebouteux and all these strains of very ancient practices, in fact. And I think that because it's and the second sight, his mother and his mother dies very quickly, but his sister has they happen. I mean, and she sees things, and in the book it happens. But at the same time, there is this very strong Presbyterian strain in the story, and I think it makes it more complex than we tend to think. Okay, we think that they are all religious fanatics. Okay, and but there is still a place in these villages, and same thing in Normandy, which Foucault says, you know, for all these practices which are outside the realm of the church. But I don't think it's I think it's really something which make the situation it's more slippery to a certain extent.�
Well, I think we should call it in, and thank you again for the takers.